7. Richard Matheson's The Shrinking Man, 1956, is another case of a fantasy novel packaged as science fiction in a rationalistic decade when even dreams had to have some sort of basis in reality, and this mislabeling of the book has continued right up to the present, for no good reason other than this is how publishers do things. "One of the most incredible science fiction classics of all time," booms the cover of the recent Berkeley reissue, ignoring the fact that a story in which a man shrinks at the steady rate of 1/7 of an inch a day has really gone beyond even the furthest realms of science fiction. Matheson, like Bradbury, has no real interest in hard science fiction. He brings forth an obligatory amount of mumbo-jumbo. My favorite is when a doctor exclaims over Scott Carey's incredible catabolism and then drops it. We know that the process, which eventually results in Scott Carey's being chased through his own basement by a black widow spider, begins when he is doused by a curtain of sparkling radioactive spray. The radioactivity interacts with some bug spray he had ingested into his system a few days earlier. It is this double play that has caused the shrinking process to begin. It is the most minimal nod at rationality, a mid-20th century version of pentagrams, mystic passes, and evil spells. Luckily for us, Matheson, like Bradbury, is more interested in Scott Carey's heart and mind than in his incredible catabolism. It's worth noting that in The Shrinking Man, we're back to the old radioactive blues again, and to the idea that horror fiction helps us to externalize in symbolic form whatever is really troubling us. It is impossible to see The Shrinking Man separated from its background of A-bomb tests, ICBMs, the missile gap, and strontium 90 in the milk. If we look at it this way, Matheson's novel, his second published book, according to John Brosnan and John Clute, who collaborated on Matheson's entry in the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, citing Matheson's I Am Legend as the first, I believe they may have overlooked two other Richard Matheson novels, Someone Is Bleeding and Fury on Sunday. Is no more science fiction than such big bug movies as The Deadly Mantis or Beginning of the End. But Matheson is doing more in The Shrinking Man than having radioactive nightmares. The title of Matheson's novel alone suggests bad dreams of a more Freudian nature. Concerning the body snatchers, we'll remember Richard Gid Powers saying that Miles Bunnell's victory over the pods is a direct result of Miles's resistance against depersonalization, his fierce individualism, and his defense of more traditional American values. These same things can be said about the Matheson novel, with one important variation. Nor is this the only time that these two very different writers have taken up a similar theme. Both have written time travel stories of men who are driven to escape a terrible present for a friendlier past. Finney's Time and Again, 1970, in which the hero returns to turn-of-the-century times on America's East Coast, and Matheson's Bid Time Return, 1975, in which the hero returns to turn-of-the-century times on America's West Coast. In both cases, their desire to escape what Powers calls cultural depersonalization is a factor, but more different treatments of the idea, and different outcomes, cannot be imagined. It seems to me that while Powers is right in suggesting that The Body Snatchers is in large part about the depersonalization, even the annihilation of the free personality in our society, The Shrinking Man is a story about the free personality's loss of power and growing impotency in a world increasingly controlled by machines, red tape, and a balance of terror where future wars are planned, with one eye always cocked toward an acceptable kill ratio. In Scott Carey, we see one of the most inspired and original symbols of this modern devaluation of human currency ever created. Carey muses at one point that he is not shrinking at all, that instead the world is growing larger. But seen either way, devaluation of the individual or inflation of the environment, the result is the same. As Scott shrinks, he retains his essential individuality but gradually loses more and more control over his world anyway. Also like Finney, Matheson sees his work as just a story, and one he is not even particularly in touch with anymore. His comments, "I started working on the book in 1955. It was the only book I ever wrote back east, if you exclude a novel I wrote when I was 16 and living in Brooklyn. Things had been going badly out here in California, and I thought it might be a good idea to be back east and close to editors for the sake of my career. I'd given up on the idea of getting into movies. Actually, there was nothing rational in the move. I was just fed up out here on the coast and talked myself into going back east. My family was there. My brother had a business there, and I knew I could get some work for us to live on if I couldn't sell any writing. In The Shrinking Man, Scott Carey's life becomes an ever louder, ever more discordant medley of anxieties. One of the greatest is the shrinking money supply and his inability to support his family as he always has. I won't say that Matheson has done anything so simple as transferring his own feelings at the time to his character, but I will suggest that perhaps Matheson's own frustrations at the time enabled him to write Carey's character that much more convincingly. So we went. We were renting a house at Sound Beach on Long Island when I wrote the book. I'd gotten the idea several years earlier while attending a movie in a Redondo Beach theater. It was a silly comedy with Ray Milland and Jane Wyman and Aldo Ray, and in this particular scene, Ray Milland, leaving Jane's apartment in a huff, accidentally put on Aldo Ray's hat, which sank down around his ears. Something in me asked, what would happen if a man put on a hat which he knew was his and the same thing happened? Thus the notion came. The entire novel was written in the cellar of the rented house on Long Island. I did a shrewd thing in that. I didn't alter the cellar at all. There was a rocking chair down there, and every morning I would go down into the cellar with my pad and pencil, and I would imagine what my hero was up to that day. Matheson's hero, Scott Carey, also goes down into the cellar every day with his pad and pencil. He, too, is writing a book. These days, isn't everybody? Scott's book is about his experiences as the world's only shrinking man, and it provides for his family quite adequately, as Matheson's own book and the subsequent film made from it did for Matheson's own family, one supposes. I didn't have to keep the environment in my mind or keep notes. I had it all there, frozen. It was intriguing, when I watched them shoot the film, to see the cellar set, because it reminded me a good deal of the cellar in Sound Beach, and I had a momentary, enjoyable sense of déjà vu. It took me about 2.5 months to write the novel. I originally used the structure the movie did, starting with the beginning of the shrinking process. This didn't work, as it took too long to get to the good stuff, so I recast the storyline to get the reader into the cellar immediately. Recently, when I thought they were going to do a remake of the film and I thought they wanted me to do it, I decided I would revert to the original structure because in the film, as in my original manuscript, the good stuff took a while to get to. But it turned out they were going to make it into a comedy with Lily Tomlin, and I wasn't going to write it anyway. John Landis was going to direct it at the time, and he wanted all the science fantasy people out here to play minor parts in the film. He wanted me to play a pharmacist who won't give a prescription to Lily Tomlin, who is so small at the time that she is sitting on the shoulder of an intelligent gorilla. Shows you how they changed the original idea. I demurred. As a matter of fact, the opening of the script is almost like my original one to the point of actual dialogue. Later, it deviates wildly. I don't think the book means anything to me at this time. None of my work does from this distant past. I think I prefer I Am Legend if I had to choose, but they are both too far from me to have any significance in particular. Accordingly, I wouldn't change anything about The Shrinking Man. It is a part of my history. I have no reason to change it, only to look at it without much interest and be pleased at whatever stir it made. I just read the first story I ever sold the other day, Born of Man and Woman, and I cannot relate to the story at all. I remember writing certain phrases, but it was someone else who wrote them. I'm sure you feel that way about the early stuff you wrote. As a matter of fact, I do. My first novel, Carrie, was written under difficult personal circumstances, and the book dealt with characters so unpleasant and so alien to my own outlook as to seem almost like Martians. When I pick up the book now, which is seldom, it does not seem as if someone else had written it, but I do get a peculiar sort of feeling from it, as if I had written it while suffering from a bad case of mental and emotional flu. The Shrinking Man only recently had a hardcover edition. Now it is being printed by the Science Fiction Book Club, too. Up to then, it was strictly softcover. Actually, I Am Legend is much more science fiction than The Shrinking Man. It has a lot of research in it. The science and the shrinking man is strictly gobbledygook. Well, I did some asking around and reading, but I hardly had a great rationale for Scott Carey's shrinking, and I winced daily that I made him shrink 1/7 of an inch a day instead of geometrically, and that I had him worry about falling from heights when it wouldn't have hurt him. Well, to hell with it. I wouldn't have written Born of Man Woman a few years later either because it is so illogical. What difference does it make, really? As I said, I enjoyed writing the book because I was like Scott Carey's Boswell, watching him each day as he made his way around the cellar. I had a piece of cake with my coffee the first few days of writing, and I laid it on the shelf, and soon it became a part of the story. I think that some of the incidents during his shrinking period are pretty good. The man who picks him up when he hitchhikes, the midget, the boys chasing him, his deteriorating marriage relationship. A summary of the shrinking man is easy to render if we view it in the linear fashion Matheson suggests. After going through the sparkling cloud of radioactivity, Carey begins to lose 1/7 of an inch a day, or roughly 1 foot per season. As Matheson suggests, this smacks of expediency, but as he also suggests, what does it matter as long as we realize that this is not hard science fiction and that it bears no resemblance to novels and stories by writers such as Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, or Larry Niven? It is not exactly sensible that the children in the C.S. Lewis tale should be able to reach another world by going through a bedroom closet either, but that is exactly what happens in the Narnia stories. It is not the technicalities of shrinking that we are interested in, and the inch-per-week pattern at least enables us to keep our own mental yardstick on Scott Carey. We are given Scott's adventures in flashbacks as he shrinks. The main action takes place in what Scott assumes is his last week of life, as he shrinks from 1 inch down to nothing. He has gotten trapped in the cellar while trying to escape his own house cat and a garden sparrow. There's something particularly chilling in Scott's desperate duel with Puss. Does anyone have the slightest doubt about what would happen if we were suddenly changed to a height of 7 inches tall by malign magic, and yon kitty curled up by the fire woke up and happened to see us skittering across the floor? Cats, those amoral gunslingers of the animal world, are maybe the scariest mammals going. I wouldn't want to be up against one in a situation like that. Perhaps above all else, Matheson excels at the depiction of one man alone, locked in a desperate struggle against a force or forces bigger than himself. Here is the conclusion of Scott's battle with the bird that knocks him into a cellar prison. He stood up, flinging more snow at the bird, seeing the snow splatter off its dark, flaring beak. The bird flapped back. Scott turned and struggled a few more strides. Then the bird was on him again, wet wings pounding at his head. He slapped wildly at it and felt his hand strike the bony sides of its beak. It flew off again. Until, finally, cold and dripping, he stood with his back to the cellar window, hurling snow at the bird in the desperate hope that it would give up and he wouldn't have to jump into the imprisoning cellar. But the bird kept coming, diving at him, hovering before him, the sound of its wings like wet sheets flapping in a heavy wind. Suddenly, the jabbing beak was hammering at his skull, slashing skin, knocking him back against the house. He picked up snow and threw it, missing. The wings were still beating at his face. The beak gashed his face again. With a stricken cry, Scott whirled and leapt for the open square. He crawled across it dizzily. The leaping bird knocked him through. When the bird knocks Scott into the cellar, the man is 7 inches tall. Matheson has made it clear that the novel is, to a large extent, a simple comparison of the macrocosm and the microcosm, and his hero's 7 weeks in this lower world are a tiny capsule of experience which exactly mimes what he has already been through in a larger world. When he falls into the cellar, he is its king. He is able to exert his own human power over the environment with no real trouble. But as he continues to shrink, his power begins to wane once again, and the nemesis appears. The spider rushed at him across the shadowed sands, scrabbling wildly on his stalk-like legs. Its body was a giant, glossy egg that trembled blackly as it charged across the windless mounds, its wake a score of sand-trickling scratches. The spider was gaining on him. its pulsing egg of a body perched on running legs, an egg whose yolk swam with killing poisons. He raced on, breathless, terror in his veins. In Matheson's view, macrocosm and microcosm are terms which are ultimately interchangeable, and all of Scott's problems throughout the shrinking process become symbolized in the Black Widow spider, which also shares Scott's cellar world. When Scott discovers the one thing in his life which has not shrunk, his ability to think and plan, he also discovers a source of power which is immutable no matter which cosm it happens to exist in. His escape from a cellar, which Matheson succeeds in making as strange and frightening as any alien world, follows, and his final heartening discovery that to nature there was no zero, and that there is a place where the macrocosm and the microcosm eventually meet. The Shrinking Man can be read simply enough as a great adventure story. It is certainly one of that select handful that I have given to people, envying them the experience of the first reading. Others would include Bloch's The Scarf, Tolkien's The Hobbit, Bertrand Rucher's Feral. But there's more going on in Matheson's novel than just adventure, a kind of surreal outward-bound program for little people. On a more thoughtful level, it is a short novel which deals in a thought-provoking way with concepts of power, power lost and power found. Let me pull back from the Matheson book briefly. Like Douglas MacArthur, I shall return, and make the following wild statement. All fantasy fiction is essentially about the concept of power. Great fantasy fiction is about people who find it at great cost, or lose it tragically. Mediocre fantasy fiction is about people who have it and never lose it, but simply wield it. Mediocre fantasy fiction generally appeals to people who feel a decided shortage of power in their own lives and obtain a vicarious shot of it by reading stories of strong thewed barbarians whose extraordinary prowess at fighting is only excelled by their extraordinary prowess at fucking. In these stories, we are apt to encounter a 7-foot-tall hero fighting his way up the alabaster stairs of some ruined temple, a flashing sword in one hand and a scantily clad beauty lolling over his free arm. This sort of fiction, commonly called sword and sorcery by its fans, is not fantasy at its lowest, but it still has a pretty tacky feel. Mostly it's the Hardy Boys dressed up in animal skins and rated R, and with cover art by Jeff Jones, as likely as not. Sword and sorcery novels and stories are tales of power for the powerless. The fellow who is afraid of being rousted by those young punks who hang around his bus stop can go home at night and imagine himself wielding a sword, his potbelly miraculously gone, his slack muscles magically transmuted into those iron thews which have been sung and storied in the pulps for the last 50 years. The only writer who really got away with this sort of stuff was Robert E. Howard, a peculiar genius who lived and died in rural Texas. Howard committed suicide as his mother lay comatose and terminally ill, apparently unable to face life without her. Howard overcame the limitations of his puerile material by the force and fury of his writing and by his imagination, which was powerful beyond his hero Conan's wildest dreams of power. In his best work, Howard's writing seems so highly charged with energy that it nearly gives off sparks. Stories such as The People of the Black Circle glow with the fierce and eldritch light of his frenzied intensity. At his best, Howard was the Thomas Wolfe of fantasy, and most of his Conan tales seemed to almost fall over themselves in their need to get out. Yet his other work was either unremarkable or just abysmal. The word will hurt and anger his legion of fans, but I don't believe any other word fits. Robert Bloch, one of Howard's contemporaries, suggested in his first letter to Weird Tales that even Conan wasn't that much shakes. Bloch's idea was that Conan should be banished to the outer darkness, where he could use his sword to cut out paper dolls. Needless to say, the suggestion did not go over well with the marching hordes of Conan fans. They probably would have lynched poor Bob Bloch on the spot, had they caught up with him back there in Milwaukee. Even below the sword and sorcery stories are the superheroes, who populate the comic magazines of the only two remaining giants in the field. Although giants is almost too strong a word, according to a survey published in a 1978 issue of Warren's Creepy magazine, comic readership has gone into what may be an irrecoverable skid. These characters, traditionally called long underwear heroes by the bullpen artists who draw them, are invincible. Blood never flows from their magical bodies. They are somehow able to bring such colorful villains as Lex Luthor and the Sandman to justice without ever having to remove their masks and testify against them in open court. They are sometimes down, but never out. One reason for the success of Marvel's Spider-Man when he burst on the comics scene in the early 60s may have been his vulnerability. He was, and is, an engaging exception to the standard comic book formula. There is something winning in his vulnerability as Peter Parker and in his frequent klutziness as Spider-Man. After being bitten by that radioactive spider, Peter originally felt no holy desire to fight crime. He decided instead to make a bundle in showbiz. Before long, however, he discovers a truth which is bitter to him and amusing to the reader. No matter how great you looked on The Sullivan Show, Marine Midland Bank still won't cash a check made out to the Amazing Spider-Man. Such touches of realism, laced with rue, can be traced to Stan Lee, Spider-Man's creator and the man probably most responsible for keeping the comic book from going the way of the pulps and the dime novels in the 60s and 70s. At the other end of the spectrum are the characters of fantasy who are either powerless and discover power within themselves, as Thomas Covenant discovers it in Stephen Donaldson's remarkable Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever trilogy, or as Frodo discovers it in Tolkien's epic tale of the Rings, or characters who lose power and then find it again, as Scott Carey does in The Shrinking Man. Horror fiction, as we've said before, is one small circular area in the larger circle of fantasy. And what is fantasy fiction but tales of magic? And what are tales of magic but stories of power? One word nearly defines the other. Power is magic, power is potency. The opposite of potency is impotence, and impotence is the loss of the magic. There is no impotence in the stories of the sword and sorcery genre, nor in those stories of Batman and Superman and Captain Marvel, which we read as children and then, hopefully, gave up as we moved on to more challenging literature and wider views of what the life experience really is. The great theme of fantasy fiction is not holding the magic and wielding it. If so, Sauron, not Frodo, would have been the hero of Tolkien's Rings cycle. It is, or so it seems to me, finding the magic and discovering how it works. In getting back to the Matheson novel, shrinking itself is an oddly arresting concept, isn't it? Tons of symbolism come immediately to mind, most of it revolving around the potency-impotency thing, sexual and otherwise. In Matheson's book, shrinking is most important because Scott Carey begins by perceiving size as power, size as potency, size as magic. When he begins to shrink, he begins to lose all three, or so he believes, until his perceptions change. His reaction to his loss of power, potency, and magic is most commonly a blind, bellowing rage.
"What do you think I'm going to do?" he burst out. "Go on letting them play with me? Oh, you haven't been there. You haven't seen. They're like kids with a new toy. A shrinking man. God Almighty, a shrinking man. It makes their damn eyes light up."
Like Thomas Covenant's constant cries of, "By hell," in the Donaldson trilogy, Scott's rage does not hide his impotency, but highlights it. And it is Scott's fury which in a large part makes him such an interesting, believable character. He is not Conan or Superman. Scott bleeds plenty before escaping his cellar prison, and as we watch him go ever more frantically about the task of trying to escape, we suspect at times that he is more than half mad. Or Doc Savage. Scott doesn't always know what to do. He fumbles the ball frequently, and when he does, he goes on to do what most of us would probably do under the circumstances. He has the adult equivalent of a tantrum. In fact, if we regard Scott's shrinking as a symbol for any incurable disease, and the progress of any incurable disease entails a kind of power loss which is analogous to shrinking, we see a pattern which psychologists would outline pretty much as Matheson wrote it, only the outline came years later. Scott follows this course from disbelief to rage to depression to final acceptance almost exactly. As with cancer patients, the final trick seems to be to accept the inevitable, perhaps to find fresh lines of power leading back into the magic. In Scott's case, in the case of many terminal patients, the final outward sign of this is an admission of the inevitable, followed by a kind of euphoria. We can understand Matheson's decision to use flashbacks in order to get to the good stuff early on, but one wonders what might have happened if he had given us the story in a straight line. We see Scott's loss of power in several widely spaced episodes. He is chased by teenagers at one point. They think, and why not, that he is just a little kid. And at another, he hitches a ride with a man who turns out to be a homosexual. He begins to feel an increasing disrespect from his daughter, Beth, partly because of the might makes right idea that works unobtrusively but powerfully in even the most enlightened parent-child relationships. Or we could say, might makes power, or might makes magic. But perhaps mostly because his steady shrinking causes Beth to have to constantly restructure her feelings about her father, who ends up living in a dollhouse before his fall into the cellar. We can even blackly visualize Beth, who doesn't really understand what's happening, inviting her friends in on a rainy day to play with her daddy. But Scott's most painful problems are with Lou, his wife. They are both personal and sexual. And I think that most men, even today, tend to identify the magic most strongly with sexual potency. A woman may not want to, but she can. A man may want to and find he cannot. Bad news. And when Scott is 4 feet 1 inch tall, he comes home from the medical center where he's been undergoing tests and walks straight into a situation where the loss of sexual magic becomes painfully evident. Louise looked up, smiling. "You look so nice and clean," she said. It was not the words or the look on her face, but suddenly he was terribly conscious of his size. Lips twitching into the semblance of a smile, he walked over to the couch and sat down beside her, instantly sorry that he had. She sniffed. "You smell nice," she said. "You look nice," he said. "Beautiful, beautiful," she scoffed. "Not me." He leaned over abruptly and kissed her warm throat. She raised her left hand and stroked his cheek slowly. "So nice and smooth," she murmured. He swallowed. Was she actually talking to him as if he were a boy? And a few minutes later, he let breath trickle slowly from his nostrils.
"I guess it would be rather grotesque anyway. It'd be like..."
"Honey, please." She wouldn't let him finish. "You're making it worse than it is."
"Look at me," he said. "How much worse can it get?"
Later on, in another flashback, we see Scott as a voyeur, spying on the babysitter Louise has hired to care for Beth. In a series of comic, horrible scenes, Scott turns the pimply, overweight babysitter into a kind of masturbatory dream goddess. In his doubling back to powerless early adolescence, Matheson is able to show us just how much of the sexual magic Scott has lost. But at a carnival some weeks later, Scott is 1.5 feet tall at this point. He meets Clarice, a sideshow midget. And in his encounter with Clarice, we have our clearest indication of Matheson's belief that the lost magic can be found again, that the magic exists on many levels and thus becomes the unifying force that makes macrocosm and microcosm one and the same. When he first meets Clarice, Scott is a bit taller than she, and in her trailer he finds a world which is once more in perspective. It is an environment where he can reassert his own power. Breath stopped. It was his world, his very own world. Chairs and a couch he could sit on without being engulfed, tables he could stand beside and reach across instead of walk under, lamps he could switch on and off, not stand futilely beneath as if they were trees. And, almost needless to relate, he also rediscovers the sexual magic with Clarice in an episode which is both pathetic and touching. We understand he will lose this magic as well, sinking away from Clarice's level, until she is also a giant to him. And while these episodes are somewhat softened by the flashback form, the point is nevertheless made. What can be found once can be found again. And the incident of Clarice most clearly justifies the novel's odd but strangely powerful ending. He thought, if nature existed on endless levels, so also might intelligence. Scott Carey ran into his new world, searching. Not, we devoutly hope, to be eaten by the first garden slug or amoeba to cross his path. In the movie version, which Matheson also wrote, Scott's final line is a triumphant, "I still exist," accompanied by shots of nebulae and exploding galaxies. I asked him if this had religious connotations, or perhaps reflected an early interest in life after death, a subject which has become more and more important in Matheson's later work, see Hell House and What Dreams May Come. Matheson comments, Scott Carey's I Still Exist, I think, only implied a continuum between macroscopic and microscopic, not between life and life after death. Interestingly, I was on the verge of doing a rewrite of The Fantastic Voyage, which Columbia is supposed to be making. I couldn't get involved in it because it was so technical, and I would rather be involved with character now. But it was like a small continuation of the end of The Shrinking Man into the microscopic world with Rod and Gunn. Overall, we can say that The Shrinking Man is a classic survival story. There is really only one character, and the questions here are elemental. Food, shelter, survival, destruction of the nemesis. The Dionysian force in Scott's mostly Apollonian cellar world. It is by no means a tremendously sexy book, but sex is at least dealt with on a level more thoughtful than the Shel Scott wham-bam-thank-you-ma'am level that was a common one for paperback originals in the 50s. Matheson was an important figure in pioneering the right of science fiction and fantasy writers to deal with sexual problems in a realistic and sensitive way. Others involved in the same struggle, and it was a struggle, would have included Philip Jose Farmer, Harlan Ellison, and, perhaps most importantly of all, Theodore Sturgeon. It is hard to believe now what a furor was caused by the concluding pages of Sturgeon's Some of Your Blood, when it is revealed exactly how the vampire has been obtaining his supply. The moon is full, he writes both wistfully and chillingly to his girlfriend in the book's final paragraph, and I wish I had some of your blood. But the furor happened. We may wish that Matheson had dealt with the sexual angle a little less solemnly, but in light of the times, I think we can applaud the fact that he dealt with the sexual angle at all. And as a fable of losing power and finding it, The Shrinking Man ranks as one of the finest fantasies of the period we've been discussing, and I don't want to leave you with the impression that I'm only talking here about sexual power and sexual potency. There are tiresome critics, the half-baked Freudians mostly, who want to relate all of fantasy and horror fiction back to sex. One explanation for the conclusion of The Shrinking Man, which I heard at a party in the fall of 1978, I'll not mention the name of the woman whose theory this was, but if you read science fiction, you'd know the name. Maybe bears repeating, since we're on this. In symbolic terms, this woman said, spiders represent the vagina. Scott finally kills his nemesis, the Black Widow, the most vaginal of all spiders, by impaling it on a pin. The phallic symbol. Get it? Get it? Thus, this critic went on, after failing at sex with his wife, succeeding at first with the carnival midget Clarice and then losing her, Scott symbolically kills his own sex drive by impaling the spider. This is his last sexual act before escaping the cellar and achieving a wider freedom. All of this was well-meaning bullshit, but bullshit is still bullshit and will never be mistaken for McDonald's secret sauce. I bring it up only to point out that it is the sort of bullshit that a lot of fantasy and horror writers have had to labor under. Most of it spread by people who believe either secretly or openly that the horror writer must be suffering from madness to a greater or a lesser degree. The further view of such folks is that the writer's books are Rorschach ink blots that will eventually reveal the author's anal, oral, or genital fixation. In writing about the largely scoffing reaction that Leslie Fiedler's Love and Death in the American Novel received when it was published in 1960, Wilfred Sheed adds, Freudian interpretations are always greeted by guffaws. Not much bad news at that, when you remember that even the most staid novelists are regarded as a bit peculiar by their neighbors. But the horror novelist is always going to have to face what I think of as the couch questions, I guess. And most of us are perfectly normal. Freudian huggermugger set aside, The Shrinking Man can be seen as just a pretty good story which happens to deal with the interior politics of power, or if you like, and I do, the interior politics of magic. And Scott's killing of the spider is meant to show us that the magic is not dependent on size, but upon mind and heart. If it stands considerably taller than other books in the genre, small pun much intended, and far above other books where tiny people battle beetles and praying mantises and such, Lindsay Gutteridge's Cold War in a Country Garden comes to mind, it is because Matheson couches his story in such intimate and riveting terms, and because he is ultimately so persuasive. This examination of lives in microcosm continues to hold a fascination for writers and readers. Early this year, Macmillan published Small World by Tabitha King, a malign comedy of manners revolving around a fabulously expensive presidential dollhouse, a nymphomaniacal presidential daughter, and an overweight mad scientist who is as pitiable as he is frightening. Published in 1981, it lies outside the temporal borders of this book, which is probably just as well. The lady is my wife, and my view would be prejudiced. So I'll only add that my prejudiced view is that Small World is a wonderful addition to this HO scale subgenre. 8. It wouldn't be right to wind up even so brief a discussion of the modern horror novel as this one without mentioning two young British writers, Ramsay Campbell and James Herbert. They are a part of a whole new generation of British fantasy writers who seem to be revitalizing the genre by cross-fertilization, much as British poets helped to revitalize American poetry during the early 60s. Besides Campbell and Herbert, the two who are perhaps best known over here, there is Robert Aikman, who could hardly be called a young Turk, but since such books as Cold Hand and Mine have brought him to a wider American audience, it seems fair enough to classify him as part of the British New Wave. Nick Sharman, Thomas Tessier, an American living in London, who has recently published a novel called The Night Walker, perhaps the finest werewolf novel of the last 20 years, and a score of others. As Paul Theroux, another expatriate American living in London, has pointed out, there is something uniquely British about the tale of horror, perhaps particularly those which deal with the archetype of the ghost. Theroux, who has written his own low-key horror tale, The Black House, favors the mannered but grisly tales of M.R. James, and they do seem to summarize everything that is best in the classic British horror story. Ramsay Campbell and James Herbert are both modernists, and while this family is really too small to avoid a certain resemblance, even in cousins twice removed, it seems to me that both of these men, who are worlds apart in terms of style, point of view, and method of attack, are doing things that are exciting and worthy of mention. Campbell, a Liverpudlian, "You talk just like one of the Beatles," a woman marvels to a writer from Liverpool in Campbell's new novel, The Parasite, writes a cool, almost icy prose line, and his perspective on his native Liverpool is always a trifle offbeat, a trifle unsettling. In a Campbell novel or story, one seems to view the world through the thin and shifting perceptual haze of an LSD trip that is just ending, or just beginning. The polish of his writing and his mannered turns of phrase and image make him seem something like the genre's Joyce Carol Oates. And like Oates, he is prolific, turning out good short stories, novels, and essays at an amazing clip. And there is also something Oatesian in the way his characters view the world, as when one is journeying on mild LSD, there is something chilly and faintly schizophrenic in the way his characters see things, and in the things they see. These are the perceptions of Rose, as she shops in a Liverpool department store in The Parasite. A group of toddlers watched her pass, their eyes painted into their sockets. On the ground floor, red and pink and yellow hands on stalks reached for her from the glove counter. Blind mauve faces craned on necks as long as arms, wigs roosted on their heads. The bald man was still staring at her. His head, which looked perched on top of a bookcase, shone like plastic beneath the fluorescent lights. His eyes were bright, flat, expressionless as glass. She thought of a display head stripped of its wig. When a fat pink tongue squeezed out between his lips, it was as if a plastic head had come to life.
"Good stuff, but strange. So uniquely Campbell that it might as well be trademarked. Good horror novels are not a dime a dozen by no means, but there never seems to be any serious shortage of good ones either. And by that I mean that you seem to be able to count on a really good novel of horror and or the supernatural, or at least a really interesting one, every year or so. And much the same could be said for the horror films. A vintage year may produce as many as three amid the paperback original dreck about hateful paranormal children and presidential candidates from hell, and the too large collection of hardcover boners, such as the recent Virgin by James Peterson. But maybe paradoxically, maybe not, good horror writers are quite rare, and Campbell is better than just good. That's one reason fans of the genre will greet The Parasite with such pleasure and relief. It is even better than his first novel, of which I want to treat briefly here. Campbell has been turning out his own patented brand of short horror tale for some years now. Like Bradbury and Robert Bloch, Arkham House published Ramsey Campbell's first book, The Inhabitant of the Lake, which was a Lovecraft clone. Several collections of his stories are available, the best of them probably being The Height of the Scream. A story you will not find in that book, unfortunately, is The Companion, in which a lonely man who tours funfairs on his holidays encounters a horror beyond my ability to describe while riding a ghost train into its tunnel. The Companion may be the best horror tale to be written in English in the last 30 years. It is surely one of half a dozen or so which will still be in print and commonly read 100 years from now. Campbell is literate in a field which has attracted too many comic book intellects, cool in a field where too many writers, myself included, tend toward panting melodrama, fluid in a field where many of the best practitioners often fall prey to cant and stupid rules of fantasy composition. But not all good short story writers in this field are able to make the jump to the novel. Poe tried with the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym and made a conditional success of the job. Lovecraft failed ambitiously twice, with The Strange Case of Charles Dexter Ward and the rather more interesting At the Mountains of Madness, whose plot is remarkably Pym-like. Campbell made the jump almost effortlessly, with a novel as good as its title was off-putting, The Doll Who Ate His Mother. The book was published with absolutely no fanfare in 1977 in hardcover, and then with an even greater lack of fanfare a year later in paperback. One of those cases that make a writer wonder if publishers don't practice their own sort of voodoo, singling certain books out to be ritually slaughtered in the marketplace. Well, never mind that. Concerning the jump from the short story to the novel, writing the latter is much like long-distance running, and you can almost feel some would-be novelists getting tired. You sense they're starting to breathe a trifle hard by page 100, to puff and blow by page 200, and to finally limp over the finish line with little to recommend them beyond the bare fact that they have finished. But Campbell runs well. He is personally an amusing, even a jolly man. At the 1979 World Fantasy Convention, he presented Stephen R. Donaldson with the British Fantasy Award, a modernistic little statuette, for his Thomas Covenant trilogy. Campbell, in that marvelously broad and calm Liverpool accent, referred to it as the skeletal dildo.
The audience broke up, and someone at my table marveled, "He sounds just like one of the Beatles." As with Robert Bloch, the last thing you would suspect is that he is a writer of horror fiction, particularly of the grim brand he turns out. Of The Doll Who Ate His Mother, he has this to say, some of it bearing directly on the difference in the amount of endurance needed to do a novel. What I wanted to do with the doll was to invent a new monster, if that is possible, but perhaps the big thing was to actually write the novel, since previously I'd been doing short stories. In 1961 or 62, I made notes for a story about a black magician who was going to take revenge on his town or village for some real or imagined wrong it had done him. He was going to do this by using voodoo dolls to deform the babies. You'd have the standard pulp magazine scene of the white-faced doctor coming out of the delivery room saying, "My God, it's not human!" And the twist was going to be that after all these deformed infants had died, the black magician would use the voodoo dolls to bring them back to life. An amazingly tasteless idea. At about the same time, the thalidomide tragedy occurred, making the story idea a little too topically tasteless for me, and I dropped it. It resurfaced, I suppose, in The Doll Who Ate His Mother, which eats its way out of its mother's womb. How does writing novels differ from writing short stories? I think a novel gathers its own impetus. I have to creep up on it unawares, thinking to myself, maybe I'll start it next week. Maybe I'll start it next month. Then one day I sat down, began to write, and looked up at noon thinking, my God, I've started a novel. I don't believe it. Kirby McCauley said, when I asked him how long the novel should be, that 70,000 words or so would be about right. And I took him almost literally. When I got up around the 63,000-word mark, I thought, only 7,000 words left. Time to wrap this up. That's why many of the later chapters seem terse. Campbell's novel begins with Claire Frayne's brother Rob losing an arm and his life in a Liverpool car accident. The arm, torn off in the accident, is important because somebody makes off with it and eats it. This muncher of arms, we are led to suppose, is a shadowy young man named Chris Kelly. Claire, who embodies many of the ideas already labeled as New American Gothic, sure, Campbell is British, but many of his influences, both literary and cinematic, are American, meets a crime reporter named Edmund Hall, who believes that the man who caused Rob Frayne's death was the grown-up version of a boy he knew in school, a boy fascinated with death and cannibalism. In dealing with archetypes, I've not suggested that we deal out a tarot card for the ghoul, one of the more grisly creatures in monsterdom, believing that the eating of dead flesh and the drinking of blood are really parts of the same archetype. Stories of ghouls and cannibalism venture into genuine taboo territory, I think. Witness the strong public reactions to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Something rather more important than a harmless roller coaster ride is going on here, I think. Here's a chance to really grab people by the gag reflex and throttle them. I wrote a story 4 years ago called Survivor Type, which I still have not been able to sell. Gee, and people told me that when I got successful, I'd be able to sell my laundry list if I wanted to. It deals with a surgeon who is washed up on an uninhabited island, little more than a scratch of coral above the surface of the Pacific, and eats himself a piece at a time to stay alive. I did everything according to Hoyle, he writes in his diary after amputating his foot. I washed it before I ate it. Not even the men's magazines would consider that one, and it sits in my file cabinet to this day, waiting for a good home. It will probably never find one, though. Is there really such a thing as a new monster? In light of the genre's strictness, I think not, and Campbell must be content instead with a fresh perspective. No mean feat in itself. In Chris Kelly, I believe the face we see is that of our old friend the vampire, as we see it in a movie which resembles Campbell's novel by turns, the brilliant Canadian director David Cronenberg's They Came From Within. Claire, Edmund Hall, and George Pugh, a cinema owner whose elderly mother has also been victimized by Kelly, join together in a strange and reluctant three-way partnership to track this supernatural cannibal down. Here again we feel echoes of the classic tale of the vampire, Stoker's Dracula. And perhaps we never feel the changes of the nearly 80 years which lie between the two books so strongly as we do in the contrast between the group of six which forms to track down Count Dracula and the group of three which forms to track down Chris Kelly. There is no sense of self-righteousness in Claire, Edmund, and George. They are truly little people, afraid, confused, often depressed. They turn inward to themselves rather than outward toward each other. And while we sense their fright very strongly, there is no feeling about the book that Claire, Edmund, and George must prevail because their cause is just They somehow symbolize the glum and rather drab place England has become in the second half of the 20th century, and we feel that if some or all of them do muddle through, it will be due more to impersonal luck than to any action of their own. And the three of them do track Kelly down, after a fashion. The climax of the hunt takes place in the rotting cellar of a slum building marked for demolition. And here, Campbell has created one of the dreamiest and most effective sequences in all of modern horror fiction. In its surreal and nightmarish evocation of ancient evil, in the glimpses it gives us of absolute power, it is finally a voice from the latter part of the 20th century which speaks powerfully in the language which Lovecraft can be said to have invented. Here is nothing so pallid or so imitative as a Lovecraft pastiche, but a viable, believable version of those Lovecraftian elder gods that so haunted Dunwich, Arkham, Providence, Central Falls, and the pages of Weird Tales magazine. Campbell is good, if rather unsympathetic, with character. His lack of emotion has the effect of chilling his prose even further, and some readers will be put off by the tone of this novel. They may feel that Campbell has not so much written a novel as grown one in a petri dish. Claire Frayne, with her stumpy legs and her dreams of grace, Edmund, with his baleful thoughts of glory yet to come, and best of all, because here Campbell does seem to kindle real feelings of emotion and kindliness, George Pugh, holding on to the last of his cinemas and scolding two teenage girls who walk out before the playing of the national anthem has finished. But perhaps the central character here is Liverpool itself, with its orange sodium lights, its slums and docks, its cinemas converted into half a mile of furniture. Campbell's short stories live and breathe Liverpool in what seems to be equal amounts of attraction and repulsion, and that sense of place is one of the most remarkable things about The Doll as well. This locale is as richly textured as Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles of the 40s and 50s, or Larry McMurtry's Houston of the 60s. Children were playing ball against the church, Campbell writes. Christ held up his arms for a catch. It is a small line, understated and almost thrown away, like all those creepy reaching gloves in The Parasite. But this sort of thing is cumulative, and at least suggests Campbell's commitment to the idea that horror exists in point of view as well as in incident. The doll who ate his mother is not the greatest of the novels discussed here. I suppose that would have to be either The Haunting of Hill House or Straub's Ghost Story, and it is not as good as Campbell's The Parasite. But it is remarkably good. Campbell keeps a tight rein on his potentially tabloid-style material, even playing off it occasionally. A dull and almost viciously insensitive teacher sits in the faculty room of his school, reading a paper with a headline which blares, "He cut up young virgins and laughed." The story's blackly hilarious subhead informs us that his potency came from not having orgasms. He carries us inexorably past levels of abnormal psychology into something that is much, much worse. Campbell is extremely conscious of his literary roots. He mentions Lovecraft, adding, of course, almost unconsciously, Robert Bloch. He compares The Doll's climax in the abandoned cellar to the climax of Psycho, where Lila Crane must face Norman Bates' mother in a similar basement, and Fritz Lieber's stories of urban horror, such as Smoke Ghost, and more notably, Lieber's eerie novel of San Francisco, Our Lady of Darkness, winner of the Best Novel Award at the 1978 World Fantasy Convention. In Our Lady of Darkness, Lieber adopts as his thesis the idea that when a city becomes complex enough, it may take on a tenebrous life of its own, quite apart from the lives of the people who live and work there, an evil sentience linked, in some unstated way, to the elder ones of Lovecraft and, more importantly, in terms of the Lieber novel, Clark Ashton Smith. Amusingly, one of the characters in Our Lady of Darkness suggests that San Francisco did not become truly sentient until the Transamerica Pyramid was finished and occupied. While Campbell's Liverpool does not have this kind of conscious evil life, the picture he draws of it gives the reader the feeling that he is observing a slumbering, semi-sentient monster that might awake at any moment. His debt to Lieber seems clearer here than that to Lovecraft, in fact. Either way, Ramsey Campbell has succeeded in forging something uniquely his own in The Doll Who Ate His Mother. James Herbert, on the other hand, comes from an older tradition, the same sort of pulp horror fiction that we associate with writers such as Robert E. Howard, Seabury Quinn, the early Sturgeon, the early Henry Kuttner, and on the English side of the Atlantic, Guy Ann Smith. Smith, the author of paperback originals beyond counting, has written a novel whose title is my nominee for the all-time pulp horror classic, The Sucking Pit. This sounds as if I were getting ready to knock Herbert, but this isn't the case. It's true that he is held in remarkably low esteem by writers in the genre of both sides of the Atlantic. When I've mentioned his name in the past, noses have automatically wrinkled. It's a little like ringing a bell in order to watch conditioned dogs salivate. But when you inquire more closely, you find that remarkably few people in the field have actually read Herbert. And the fact is that James Herbert is probably the best writer of pulp horror to come along since the death of Robert E. Howard. And I believe that Conan's creator would have responded to Herbert's work with immediate enthusiasm. Although the two men were opposite in many ways, Howard was big and broad-shouldered. The face in those pictures which remain to us is expressionless, with, we might think, undertones of either shyness or suspicion. James Herbert is of medium height, slim, quick to smile or frown, open and frank. Of course, the biggest difference may be that Howard is dead and Herbert ain't. Ha ha! Howard's best work, his stories of Conan the Barbarian, are in the mythic country of Sumeria, far in a similarly mythic past, inhabited by monsters and beautiful sexy maidens in need of rescue. And Conan will be happy to effect said rescue, if the price is right. Herbert's work is set firmly in England's present, most commonly against the backdrop of London or the southern counties which surround it. Howard was brought up in rural circumstances. He lived and died in a small sagebrush town called Cross Plains, Texas. Herbert was born in London's East End, the son of street traders, and his work reflects a checkered career as a rock and roll singer, artist, and ad executive. It is in the elusive matter of style, a confusing word that may be most accurately defined as plan or method of attack, that Herbert strongly recalls the Howard that was. In his novels of horror, The Rats, The Fog, The Survivor, The Spear, The Lair, and The Dark, Herbert does not just write. As Robert E. Howard did, he puts on his combat boots and goes out to assault the reader with horror. Let me also take a moment to point out one similarity that James Herbert and Ramsey Campbell do share, simply by virtue of their Englishness. They both write that clear, lucid, grammatical prose that only those educated in England seem able to produce. You'd think that the ability to write lucid prose would be the bottom line for any publishing novelist, but it is not so. If you don't believe me, go check out the paperback originals rack at your local bookstore. I promise you such a carnival of dangling participles, misplaced modifiers, and even lack of agreement between subject and verb that your hair may turn white. You would expect that proofreaders and copy editors would pick this sort of stuff up, even if the writers of such embarrassing English do not, but many of them seem as illiterate as the writers they are trying to bail out. Worse than the mechanical errors, many writers of fiction seem totally unable to explain simple operations or actions clearly enough for the reader to be able to see them in his or her mind's eye. Some of this is a failure on the writer's part to visualize well and completely. His or her own mind's eye seems bleared half shut. More of it is a simple failure of that most basic writer's tool, the working vocabulary. If you're writing a haunted house story and you don't know the difference between a gable and a gambrel, a cupola and a turret, paneling and wainscoting, you, sir or madam, are in trouble. Now don't get me wrong here. I thought Edwin Newman's book on the degeneration of the English language was moderately entertaining, but also often tiresome and amazingly prissy. The book of a man who would like to put language inside a hermetically sealed bell jar, like a carefully groomed corpse inside a glass coffin, instead of sending it out into the streets to jive with the people. But language has its own point and reason for being. Parapsychologists may argue over extrasensory perception. Psychologists and neurologists may claim there is no such thing. But those who love books and love the language know that the printed word really is a kind of telepathy. In most cases, the writer does her or his work silently, couching thoughts in symbols composed of letters, in groups, set off one from the next by white space, and in most cases, the reader does her or his work silently, reading the symbols and reintegrating them as thoughts and images. Louis Zukofsky, the poet, A, among other books, claimed that even the look of words on the page, the indents, the punctuation, the place on the line where the paragraph ends, has its own story to tell. Prose, Zukofsky said, is poetry. It's probably true that the writer's thoughts and the reader's thoughts never tally exactly, that the image the writer sees and the image the reader sees are never 100% the same. We are, after all, not angels, but we're made a little less than the angels, and our language is maddeningly hobbled, a fact to which any poet or novelist will attest. There is no creative writer, I think, who has not suffered that frustrating crash off the walls which stand at the limits of language, who has not cursed the word that just doesn't exist. Emotions such as grief and romantic love are particularly hard to deal with, but even such a simple operation as starting up a car with a manual transmission and driving it to the end of the block can present nearly insurmountable problems if you try to write the process down instead of simply doing it. And if you don't believe this is so, write down such instructions and try them on a non-driving friend. But check your auto insurance policy first. Different languages seem particularly suited to different purposes. The French may have gotten a reputation for being great lovers because the French language seems particularly well suited to the expression of emotion. There is no nicer way to say it than je t'aime, and no better language in which to sound really jacked off at someone. German is the language of explanation and clarification, but it is a cold language for all that. The sound of many people speaking German is the sound of large machines running in a factory. English serves very well to express thought and moderately well to express image, but there is nothing inherently lovely about it. Although, as someone has pointed out, it has its queerly perverse moments. Think of the lovely and euphonious sound of the words proctological examination. It has always seemed to me ill-suited to the expression of feeling, though. Neither why don't we go to bed together, or the cheerful but undeniably crude baby, let's fuck, can touch voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir? But we must do the best we can with what we have, and as readers of Shakespeare and Faulkner will attest, the best we can do is often remarkably good. American writers are more apt to mangle the language than our British cousins, although I'd argue with anyone that English English is much more bloodless than American English. Many British writers have the unhappy habit of droning in perfectly grammatical English. But a drone is still a drone for all that and all that, often because they were subjected to poor or erratic teaching methods as children. But the best American work is striking in a way that British prose and poetry rarely is anymore. See, for instance, such disparate writers as James Dickey, Harry Cruse, Joan Didion, Ross Macdonald, John Irving. Both Campbell and Herbert write that unmistakable, impeccable English line. Their stories go out into the world with their pants buttoned, their zippers zipped, and their braces in their places. But to what a different ultimate effect! James Herbert comes at us with both hands, not willing to simply engage our attention. He seizes us by the lapels and begins to scream in our faces. It is not a tremendously artistic method of attack, and no one is ever going to compare him to Doris Lessing or V.S. Naipaul. But it works. The Fog, no relation to the film of the same name by John Carpenter, is a multiple viewpoint story about what happens when an underground explosion breaches a steel canister that has been buried by the British Ministry of Defense. The canister contains a living organism called a mycoplasma, an ominous protoplasm that may remind readers of an obscure Japanese horror film from the 50s titled The H-Man, which resembles a smoggy yellow-green mist. Like rabies, it attacks the brains of the humans and animals it envelops, turning them into raving maniacs. Some of the incidents involving animals are particularly grisly. A farmer is trampled to death by his own cows in a foggy pasture, and a drunken shopkeeper, who seems to loathe everything but his racing pigeons, and one battered old campaigner in particular, a pigeon named Claude, has his eyes picked out by his birds, who have flown back to their London coop through the fog. The shopkeeper, clutching the remains of his face, staggers off the rooftop, where the birds are quartered, and falls to his death. Herbert rarely finesses and never pulls back from the crunch. Instead, he seems to race eagerly, zestfully, toward each new horror. In one scene, a crazed bus driver castrates the teacher who has been his nemesis with a pair of garden shears. In another, an elderly poacher who has been previously caught and thrashed by the local large landowner suffers the effects of the fog, goes after the landowner, and nails him to his own dining room table before finishing him off with an axe. A snotty bank manager is locked in his own vault. A gym teacher is beaten to death by his phys ed students. And in the book's most effective scene, almost 150,000 residents and holidaymakers at Bournemouth walk into the ocean in a massive lemming-like group suicide. The Fog was published in 1975, 3 years before the gruesome events at Jonestown, Guyana, and in many of the book's episodes, particularly in the Bournemouth episode, Herbert seems to have forecast it. We see the event through the eyes of a young woman named Mavis Evers. Her lesbian lover has just left her, having discovered the joys of going hetero. And Mavis has gone to Bournemouth to commit suicide. A little irony worthy of EC Comics at their best. She wades breast-deep into the water, becomes frightened, and decides she will try living a little longer. The undertow nearly gets her, but following a short, tense struggle, she is able to get to shallow water again. Turning to face the shore, Mavis is greeted by this nightmare. There were hundreds, could it be thousands, of people climbing down the steps to the beach and walking toward her, toward the sea. Was she dreaming? The people of the town were marching in a solid wall out to the sea, making no sound, staring toward the horizon as though something was beckoning to them. Their faces were white, trance-like, barely human. And there were children among them. Some walked along on their own, seeming to belong to no one. Those that couldn't walk were being carried. Most of the people were in their nightclothes. Some were naked, having risen from their beds as though answering a call that Mavis neither heard nor saw. This was written before the Jonestown tragedy, remember? In the aftermath of that, I recall one commentator intoning with dark and solemn sonorousness, "It was an event that not even the most darkly fertile imagination could have envisioned." I flashed on the Bournemouth scene from the fog and thought, "You're wrong. James Herbert envisioned it." Still they came on, oblivious to her cries, unseeing. She realized her danger and ran toward them in a vain attempt to break through, but they forced her back, heedless of her pleas as she strained against them. She managed to push a short path through them, but the great numbers before her were unconquerable, pushing her back, back into the waiting sea. Well, as you probably guessed, poor old Mavis gets her suicide whether she wants it or not. And in point of fact, it is explicit scenes of horror and violence like the one just described which have made Herbert the focus of a great deal of criticism in his native England. He told me that he finally got sick enough of the "do you write violence for the sake of violence" question to finally blow up at a reporter. "That's right," he said. "I write violence for the sake of violence, just as Harold Robbins writes sex for the sake of sex, and Robert Heinlein writes science fiction for the sake of science fiction, and Margaret Drabble writes literature for the sake of literature. Except no one ever asks them, do they?" As to how Herbert came to write The Fog, he replies,
It's about impossible to remember where any idea comes from. I mean, a single idea may come from many sources, but as clearly as I can recall, the kernel came during a business meeting. I was with an advertising firm then, and sitting in the office of my creative director, who was a rather dull man. And all of a sudden, it occurred to me, what would happen if this man just turned, walked to the window, opened it, and stepped out? Herbert turned the idea over in his mind for some time and finally sat down to do the novel, spending about 8 months' worth of weekends and late nights getting it together. The thing I like best about it, he says, is that it had no limits of structure or place. It could simply go on and on until the thing resolved itself. I liked working with my main characters, but I also liked the vignettes, because when I got tired of what my heroes were up to, I could go off on just about any tangent I liked. My feeling throughout the writing was, I'm just going to enjoy myself. I'm going to try to go over the top, to see how much I can get away with. In its construction, The Fog shows the effect of those apocalyptic big bug movies of the late 50s and early 60s. All the ingredients are there. We have a mad scientist who was screwing around with something he didn't understand and was killed by the mycoplasma he invented. The military testing secret weapons and unleashing the horror. The young scientist hero, John Holman, who we first meet bravely rescuing a little girl from the fissure that has unleashed the fog on an unsuspecting world. The beautiful girlfriend, Casey. The obligatory gathering of scientists who natter about the F-100 method of fog dispersion and lament the fact that carbon dioxide can't be used to disperse the fog because the organism thrives on it, and who inform us that the fog is really a pleuropneumonia-like organism. We will recognize these obligatory trappings of science fiction from such movies as Tarantula, The Deadly Mantis, Them, and a dozen others. Yet we will also recognize that trappings are all they are, and the heart of Herbert's novel lies not in the fog's origin or composition, but in its decidedly Dionysian effects. Murder, suicide, sexual aberrations, and all manner of deviant behavior. Holman, the hero, is our representative from a saner Apollonian world. And to do Herbert full justice, he manages to make Holman a good deal more interesting than the zero heroes played by William Hopper, Craig Stevens, and Peter Graves in various of the big bug films. Or consider, if you will, poor old Hugh Marlowe in Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, whose entire set of lines during the last third of the movie seems to consist of, "Keep firing at saucer!" and "Fire at saucer until it crashes!" Nonetheless, our interests in Holman's adventures and whether or not his girlfriend Casey will recover from the effects of her own bout with the fog, and what will be her reaction to the information that she plunged a scissors into her father's stomach while under the influence, seems pallid when compared to our morbid, let's slow down and look at the accident, interest in the old lady who is eaten alive by her pet cats, or the crazed pilot who crashes his loaded jumbo jet into the London skyscraper where his wife's lover works. I suppose that popular fiction divides itself quite naturally into two halves, what we call mainstream fiction and that which I would call pulp fiction. The pulps, including the so-called shutter pulps, of which Weird Tales was the finest exponent, have been long gone from the scene. But they live on in the novel and do a brisk business on paperback racks everywhere. Many of these modern pulps would have been printed as multi-part serials in the pulp magazines that existed roughly from 1910 until about 1950, had they been written during that period. But I wouldn't restrict the label pulp simply to genre works of horror, fantasy, science fiction, detective, and western. Arthur Haley, for instance, seems to me to be writing modern-day pulp. The ingredients are all there, from the inevitable violence to the inevitable maiden in distress. The critics who have regularly toasted Haley over the coals are the same critics who, infuriatingly enough, see the novel as divisible only into two categories, literature, which may either succeed or fail upon its merits, and popular fiction, which always fails, no matter how good it may be. Every now and then, a writer such as John D. MacDonald, may be elevated in the critical mind from a writer of popular fiction to a writer of literature, at which point his body of work may be safely reevaluated. My own idea is that fiction actually falls into three main categories: literature, mainstream fiction, and pulp fiction, and that to categorize does not end the critic's job, but only gives him or her a place to set his or her feet. To label a novel pulp is not the same as saying it's a bad novel, or will give the reader no pleasure. Of course, we will readily accept that most pulp fiction is indeed bad. There is not a great deal one can say in defense of such brass oldies from the pulp era as William Shelton's Seven Heads of Bushongo or Satan's Virgin by Ray Cummings. And there's a wonderful story about Earl Stanley Gardner's days in what Frank Gruber used to call the pulp jungle. At that time, the Depression was in full swing and Gardner was writing westerns for a penny a word, selling to such publications as Western Roundup, West Weekly, and Western Tales, whose slogan was 15 stories, 15 cents. Gardner admitted that he made a habit of stretching the final shootout as far as it would go. Of course, the bad guy finally bit the dust and the good guy strode into the saloon, 44s smoking and spurs jingling, for a cold Sir Sarsaparilla before moving on. But in the meantime, each time Gardner wrote bang, he made another penny. And in those days, two bangs would buy you the daily newspaper. On the other hand, though, Dashiell Hammett published extensively in the pulps, most notably in the highly regarded Black Mask, where contemporaries Raymond Chandler, James M. Cain, and Cornell Woolrich also published. Tennessee Williams's first published work, a vaguely Lovecraftian tale titled The Vengeance of Nitocris, appeared in an early issue of Weird Tales. Bradbury broke in by way of the same market. So did McKinley Cantor, who would go on to write Andersonville. To condemn pulp writing out of hand is like condemning a girl as loose simply because she comes from unpleasant family circumstances. The fact that supposedly reputable critics, both in the genre and outside it, continue to do so make me both sad and angry. James Herbert is not a nascent Tennessee Williams only waiting for the right time to spin a cocoon and emerge as a great figure of modern literature. He is what he is, and that's all that he is, as Popeye would say. My point is simply that what he is good enough. I loved John Jakes's comment on his bicentennial Kent family saga some years back. He said that Gore Vidal was the Rolls-Royce of historical novelists, that he himself was more in the Chevrolet Vega class. What Jakes so modestly left unstated was that both vehicles will get you where you want to go quite adequately. How you feel about style is between you and you. James Herbert is the only writer discussed in these pages who is squarely in the pulp tradition. He specializes in violent death, bloody confrontation, explicit and in some cases kinky sex, strong and virile young heroes possessed of beautiful girlfriends. The problem which needs to be solved is in most cases apparent, and the story's emphasis is put squarely on solving that problem. But Herbert works effectively within his chosen genre. He has consistently refused, from the very first, to be satisfied with characters who are nothing more than cardboard cutouts, which he moves around the playing field of his novel. In most cases, we are given motivations we can identify with and believe in, as in the case of poor, suicide-bound Mavis. Mavis reflects with a kind of pitiful, deranged defiance that she wanted them to know she had taken her own life. Her death, unlike her life, had to have some meaning, even if it was only Ronnie who fully understood that reason. This is hardly stunning character insight, but it is fully adequate to Herbert's purposes, and if the ironic outcome is similar to the ironic outcome of the Tales in EC's series of horror comics, we are able to see more and thus believe more, a victory for Herbert which the reader can share. Further, Herbert has continued to improve. The Fog is his second novel. Those that follow show a gratifying development in the writer, culminating perhaps in The Spear, which shows us a writer who has stepped out of the pulp arena altogether and has entered the wider field of the mainstream novel. 9. Which brings us to Harlan Ellison and all kinds of problems. Because here it is impossible to separate the man from the work. I've decided to close this brief review of some of the elements in modern horror fiction by discussing Ellison's work because, although he repudiates the label horror writer, he sums up, for me, the finest elements of the term. Closing with Ellison is perhaps almost mandatory because in his short stories of fantasy and horror, he strikes closest to all those things which horrify and amuse us, sometimes both at the same time, in our present lives. Ellison is haunted by the death of Kitty Genovese, a murder that comes up in his The Whimper of Whipped Dogs and in several of his essays, the mass suicides in Jonestown, and he is convinced that Iran's Ayatollah has created a senile dream of power in which we are now all living, like men and women in a fantasy tale who ultimately come to realize they are living in a psychotic's hallucinations. Most of all, it seems to me that Ellison's work is the proper place to conclude because he never looks back. He has been the field's point man for 15 years now, and if there is such a thing as a fantasist for the 1980s, always assuming there are a 1980s, then Harlan Ellison is almost surely that writer. He has quite deliberately provoked a storm of controversy over his own work. One writer in the field whom I know considers him to be a modern incarnation of Jonathan Swift, and another regularly refers to him as that no-talent son of a bitch. It is a storm that Ellison lives in quite contentedly. "You're not a writer at all," an interviewer once told me in slightly wounded tones. "You're a goddamn industry. How do you ever expect serious people to take you seriously if you keep turning out a book a year?" Well, in point of fact, I'm not a goddamn industry, unless it's a cottage industry. I work steadily, that's all. Any writer who only produces a book every 7 years is not thinking deep thoughts. Even a long book takes at most 3 years to think and write. No, a writer who only produces one book every 7 years is simply dicking off. But my own fecundity, however fecund that may be, pales before Ellison's, who has written at a ferocious clip. At this point, he has published just over 1,000 short stories. In addition to all the stories published under his own name, Ellison has written as Nalra Nazil, Slay Harson, Landon Ellis, Derry Tiger, Price Curtis, Paul Merchant, Lee Archer, E.K. Jarvis, Ivor Jorgensen, Clyde Mitchell, Ellis Hart, Jay Solo, Jay Charby, Wallace Edmondson, and Cordwainer Bird. All quoted in the Ellison entry by John Clute and Peter Nichols in the Science Fiction Encyclopedia. To point out the obvious, Nalra Nazil is Harlan Ellison spelled backwards. Other names Ellison used, E.K. Jarvis, Ivor Jorgensen, and Clyde Mitchell, were so-called house names. In pulp terminology, a house name was the name of a totally fictional writer who was, nevertheless, extremely prolific, mostly because several, sometimes dozens, of writers published works under that name when they had another story in the same magazine. Thus, Ivor Jorgensen wrote Ellison-style fantasy when he was Ellison and sexy pulp-style horror, as in the Jorgensen novel Rest in Agony, when he was someone else, in this case, Paul Fairman. To this should be added that Ellison has since acknowledged all of his pseudonymous work and has published only under his own name since 1965. He has, he says, a lemming-like urge to be up front. The Cordwainer Bird name is a good example of Ellison's restless wit and his anger at work he feels to be substandard dreck. Since the early 60s, he has done many TV scripts, including produced scripts for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Young Lawyers, The Outer Limits, and what many fans feel may have been the best Star Trek episode of them all, The City on the Edge of Forever. This may be the longest footnote in history, but I really must pause and tell two more Harlan stories, one apocryphal, the other Harlan's version of the same incident. The apocryphal, which I first heard at a science fiction bookstore, and later at several different fantasy and science fiction conventions, it was told that Paramount Pictures had a pre-production conference of big-name science fiction writers prior to shooting on Star Trek, the movie. The purpose of the conference was to toss around ideas for a mission that would be big enough to fly the starship Enterprise from the cathode tube to the silver screen, and big was the word that the exec in charge of the conference kept emphasizing. One writer suggested that the Enterprise might be sucked into a black hole. The Disney people scoffed that idea up about 3 months later. The Paramount exec didn't think that was big enough. Another suggested that Kirk, Spock, and company might discover a pulsar that was, in fact, a living organism. Still not big enough, the writer was admonished. The writers were again reminded that they should think big. According to the tale, Ellison sat silent, doing a slow burn. Only with Harlan, a slow burn lasts only about 5 seconds. Finally, he spoke up. The Enterprise, he said, goes through an interstellar warp, the great granddaddy of all interstellar warps. It's transported over a google of light years in the space of seconds and comes out at a huge gray wall. The wall marks the edge of the entire universe. Scotty rigs full-charge ion blasters, which breach the wall so they can see what's beyond the edge of everything. Peering through at them, bathed in an incredible white light, is the face of God himself. A brief period of silence followed this. Then the exec said, "It's not big enough. Didn't I just tell you guys to think really big?" In response, Ellison is supposed to have flipped the guy the bird, the cordwainer bird, one assumes, and walked out. Here is Harlan Ellison's recitation of the true facts. Paramount had been trying to get a Star Trek film in work for some time. Roddenberry was determined that his name would be on the writing credit somehow. The trouble is, he can't write for sour owl poop. His one idea, done 6 or 7 times in the series and again in the feature film, is that the crew of the Enterprise goes into deepest space, finds God, and God turns out to be insane, or a child, or both. I'd been called in twice, prior to 1975, to discuss the story. Other writers had also been milked. Paramount couldn't make up their minds and had even kicked Gene off the project a few times, until he brought in lawyers. Then the palace guard changed again at Paramount, and Diller and Eisner came over from ABC and brought a cadre of their buddies. One of them was an ex-set designer named Mark Trabulus. Roddenberry suggested me as the scenarist for the film with this Trabulus, the latest of the know-nothing duds Paramount had assigned to the troublesome project. I had a talk with Gene about a storyline. He told me they kept wanting bigger and bigger stories, and no matter what was suggested, it wasn't big enough. I devised a storyline, and Gene liked it, and set up a meeting with Trabulus for 11 December 1975. That meeting was canceled, but we finally got together on 15 December. It was just Gene Roddenberry and Trabulus and me in Gene's office on the Paramount lot. I told them the story. It involved going to the end of the known universe to slip back through time to the Pleistocene period when man first emerged. I postulated a parallel development of reptile life that might have developed into the dominant species on Earth had not mammals prevailed. I postulated an alien intelligence from a far galaxy where the snakes had become the dominant life form, and a snake creature who had come to Earth in the Star Trek future had seen its ancestors wiped out and who had gone back into the far past of Earth to set up distortions in the time flow so the reptiles could beat the humans. The Enterprise goes back to set time right, finds the snake alien, and the human crew is confronted with a moral dilemma of whether it had the right to wipe out an entire life form just to ensure its own territorial imperative in our present and future. The story, in short, spanned all of time and all of space with a moral and ethical problem. Trabulus listened to all this and sat silently for a few minutes. Then he said, "You know, I was reading this book by a guy named Von Daniken, and he proved that the Maya calendar was exactly like ours, so it must have come from aliens. Could you put in some Mayans?" I looked at Gene. Gene looked at me. He said nothing. I looked at Trabulus and said, "There weren't any Mayans at the dawn of time." And he said, "Well, who's to know the difference?" And I said, "I'm to know the difference. It's a dumb suggestion." So Trabulus got very uptight and said he liked Mayans a lot, and why didn't I do it if I wanted to write this picture? So I said, "I am a writer. I don't know what the fuck you are. And I got up and walked out. And that was the end of my association with the Star Trek movie. Which leaves the rest of us mortals, who can never find exactly the right word at exactly the right time, with nothing to say but, "Right on, Harlan." At the same time he was writing these scripts for television and winning an unprecedented 3 Writers Guild of America awards for best dramatic television scripts in the process, Ellison was engaging in a bitter running battle, a kind of creative guerrilla warfare with other TV producers over what he regarded as a deliberate effort to degrade his work and to degrade the medium itself, to Cuisinart it, in Ellison's own words. In cases where he felt his work had become so watered down that he no longer wanted his name on the credits, he would substitute the name of Cordwainer Bird, a name that comes up again in the New York Review of Bird, in Strange Wine, a madly amusing story that might well be subtitled The Chicago Seven Visit Brentano's. Cordwainer is an archaic English word for shoemaker, so the literal meaning of Ellison's pen name for scripts which he feels have been perverted beyond any kind of useful life is one who makes shoes for birds. It is, I think, as good an explanation as any for the work that television is engaged in, and suggests quite well the nature of its usefulness. It is not the purpose of this book to talk about people per se, nor is it the purpose of this chapter on horror fiction to fulfill a personal glimpse of the writer sort of function. That is the job of the out-of-the-pages section in People magazine, which my youngest son, with unknowing critical acuity, insists on calling Pimple. But in the case of Harlan Ellison, the man and his work have become so entwined that it is impossible to pull them completely apart. The book I want to talk about here is Ellison's collection of short fiction, Strange Wine, 1978. But each Ellison collection seems built on the collections which have preceded it. Each seems to be Ellison's report to the outside world on the subject, "This is where Harlan is now." And so it becomes necessary to discuss this book in a more personal way. He demands it of himself, and while that doesn't specially matter, his work also demands it, and that does matter. Ellison's fiction is, and always has been, a nervous bundle of contradictions. He's not a novelist, he says, but he has written at least 2 novels, and one of them, Rockabilly, later retitled Spider Kiss, remains one of the 2 or 3 best novels ever to be published about the cannibalistic world of rock and roll music. He says he's not a fantasist, but nearly all of his stories are fantasies. In the course of Strange Wine, for instance, we meet a writer whose work is done for him by gremlins, after the writer himself has gone dry. We also meet a nice Jewish boy who was haunted by his mother after she dies. "Mom, why don't you get off my case?" Lance, the nice Jewish boy in question, asks the ghost desperately at one point. "I saw you playing with yourself last night," the shade of Mom returns sadly. In the introduction to the book's most frightening story, Croatoan, Ellison says he is pro-choice when it comes to abortion, just as he has said in both his fiction and in his essays over the last 20 years that he is an affirmed liberal and free thinker. Ellison anecdote number 2. My wife and I attended a lecture that Harlan gave at the University of Colorado in the fall of 1974. He had, at that time, just finished Croatoan, the skin freezer which leads off Strange Wine, and he'd had a vasectomy 2 days before. "I'm still bleeding," he told the audience, "and my lady can attest that I'm telling the truth." The lady did so attest, and an elderly couple began to make their way out of the auditorium looking a bit shocked. Harlan waved a cheery goodbye to them from the podium. "Night, folks," he called. "Sorry it wasn't what you wanted." But Croatoan, and most of Ellison's short stories, are as sternly moralistic as the words of an Old Testament prophet. In many of the out-and-out horror tales, there is more than a whiff of those tales from the vault of horror ghastlies, where the climax so often involves the evildoer having his crimes revisited upon himself, only raised to the 10th power. But the irony cuts with a keener blade in Ellison's work, and we have less feeling that rough justice has been meted out and the balance restored. In Ellison's stories, we have little sense of winners and losers. Sometimes there are survivors. Sometimes there are no survivors. Croatoan uses that myth of alligators under the streets of New York as its starting point. See also Thomas Pynchon's V and a funny horrible novel called Death Tour by David J. Michael. This is an oddly pervasive urban nightmare. But Ellison's story is really about abortion. He may not be anti-abortion. Nowhere in his intro to this story does he say he's pro-abortion, however. But the story is certainly more sharply honed and unsettling than that tattered piece of yellow journalism which all right-to-lifers apparently keep in their wallets or purses so they can wave it under your nose at the drop of an opinion. This is the one which purports to have been written by a baby while in utero. I can't wait to see the sun and the flowers, the fetus gushes. I can't wait to see my mother's face smiling down at me. It ends, of course, with the fetus saying, Last night my mother killed me. Croatoan begins with the protagonist flushing the aborted fetus down the toilet. The ladies who have done the deed to the protagonist's girlfriend have packed their DNC tools and left. Carol, the woman who has had the abortion, flips out and demands that the protagonist go and find the fetus. Trying to placate her, he goes out into the street with a crowbar, levers up a manhole cover, and descends into a different world. The alligator story began, of course, as a result of the give a kid a baby alligator, aren't they just the cutest little things? Craze of the mid-50s. The kid who got the gator would keep it for a few weeks. Then the tiny alligator would all of a sudden not be so tiny anymore. It would nip, perhaps draw blood, and down the toilet it went. It was not so far-fetched to believe that they might all be down there on the black underside of our society, feeding, growing bigger, waiting to gobble up the first unwary sewer repairman to come sloshing along in his hip waders. As David Michael points out in Death Tour, the problem is that most sewers are much too cold to sustain life in fully grown alligators, let alone in those still small enough to flush away. Such a dull fact, however, is hardly enough to kill such a powerful image. And I understand that a movie which takes this image as its text is on the way. Ellison has always been a sociological sort of writer, and we can almost feel him seizing upon the symbolic possibilities of such an idea. And when the protagonist descends deep enough into this purgatorial world, he discovers a mystery of cryptic Lovecraftian proportions. At the entrance of their land, someone, not the children, they couldn't have done it, long ago built a road sign. It is a rotted log on which has been placed, carved from fine cherry wood, a book and a hand. The book is open, and the hand rests on the book, one finger touching the single word carved in the open pages. The word is Croatoan. Further along, the secret is revealed. Like the alligators of the myth, the fetuses have not died. The sin is not so easily gotten rid of. Used to swimming in placental waters, in their own way as primitive and reptilian as alligators themselves, the fetuses have survived the flush and live here in the dark, symbolically existing in the filth and the shit dropped down on them from the society of our overworld. They are the embodiment of such Old Testament maxims as, Sin never dies, and Be sure your sin will find you out. Down here in this land beneath the city live the children. They live easily and in strange ways. I am only now coming to know the incredible manner of their existence. How they eat, what they eat, how they manage to survive, and have managed for hundreds of years. These are all things I learn day by day with wonder surmounting wonder. I am the only adult here. They have been waiting for me. They call me Father. At its simplest, Croatoan is a tale of the just revenge. The protagonist is a rotter who has casually impregnated a number of women. The abortion on Carol is not the first one his friends Denise and Joanna have performed for this irresponsible Don Juan, although they swear it will be the last. The just revenge is that he finds his dodged responsibilities have been waiting for him all along, as implacable as the rotting corpse, which so often returned from the dead to hunt down its killer in the archetypical haunt of fear story. The Graham Ingalls classic, Horror We? How's Bayou? For instance. But Ellison's prose style is arresting. His grasp of this myth image of the lost alligators seems solid and complete, and his evocation of this unsuspected underworld is marvelous. Most of all, we sense outrage and anger. As with the best Ellison stories, we sense personal involvement, and have a feeling that Ellison is not so much telling the tale as he is jabbing it viciously out of its hiding place. It is the feeling that we are walking over a lot of jagged glass in thin shoes, or running across a minefield in the company of a lunatic. Accompanying these feelings is the feeling that Ellison is preaching to us, not in any lackluster ho-hum way, but in a large, bellowing voice that may make us think of Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. His best stories seem strong enough to contain morals as well as themes, and the most surprising and gratifying thing about his short fiction is that he gets away with the moralizing. We find he rarely sells his birthright for a plot of message. It should not be so, but in his fury, Ellison manages to carry everything, not at a stagger, but at a sprint. In Hitler Painted Roses, we have Margaret Thrushwood, whose sufferings make Job's look like a bad case of athlete's foot. In this fantasy, Ellison supposes, much as Stanley Elkin does in The Living End, that the reality we experience in the afterlife depends on politics, namely on what people back here think of us. Further, it posits a universe where God, a multiple God here, referred to as they, is an image-conscious poseur with no real interest in right or wrong. Margaret's lover, a Mr. Milquetoast veterinarian named Doc Thomas, murders the entire Ramsdell family in 1935 when he discovers that the hypocritical Ramsdell, "I'll have no whores in my house," Ramsdell says when he catches Margaret in the kip with Doc, has been helping himself to a bit of Margaret every now and then. Ramsdell's definition of whore apparently begins when Margaret's sex partner stops being him. Only Margaret survives Doc's berserk rage, and when she is discovered alive by the townspeople, she is immediately assumed guilty, carried to the Ramsdell well naked, and pitched in. Margaret is sent to hell for the crime she is presumed to have committed, while Doc Thomas, who dies peacefully in his bed 26 years later, goes to heaven. Ellison's vision of heaven also resembles Stanley Elkin's in The Living End. Paradise, Elkin tells us, resembles a small theme park. Ellison sees it as a place where moderate beauty balances off, but just barely, moderate tackiness. There are other similarities. In both cases, good, nay, saintly, people are sent to hell because of what amounts to a clerical error. And in this desperate view of the modern condition, even the gods are existential. The only horror we are spared is a vision of the Almighty in Adidas sneakers with a head tennis racket over his shoulder and a golden Coke spoon around his neck. All of this comes next year, no doubt. Before we leave the comparison entirely, let me point out that while Elkin's novel was heavily, and for the most part favorably, reviewed, Ellison's story, originally published in Penthouse, a magazine not regularly purchased by seekers after literary excellence, is almost unknown. Strange Wine itself is almost unknown, in fact. Most critics ignore fantasy fiction because they don't know what to do with it, unless it is out-and-out allegory. I do not choose to review fantasy, a sometime critic for no less an organ than the New York Times Book Review once told me. I have no interest in the hallucinations of the mad. It's always good to be in contact with such an open mind. It broadens one. Margaret Thrushwood escapes hell through a fluke, and in his heroically overblown description of the auguries which foreshadow this supernatural belch, Ellison has an amusing whack at rewriting Act One of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Humor and horror are the original Chang and Eng of literature, and Ellison knows it. We laugh, but there is still that undercurrent of unease. As the smoldering sun passed the celestial equator going north to south, numberless portents revealed themselves. A two-headed calf was born in Dorset, near the little town of Blandford. Wrecked ships rose from the depths of the Marianas Trench. Everywhere, children's eyes grew old and very wise. Over the Indian state of Maharashtra, clouds assumed the shapes of warring armies. Leprous moss quickly grew on the south side of Celtic megaliths, and then died away in minutes. In Greece, the pretty little gillyflowers began to bleed, and the earth around their clusters gave off a putrescent smell. All 16 of the ominous Dirae, designated by Julius Caesar in the 1st century BC, including the spilling of salt and wine, stumbling, sneezing, and the creaking of chairs, made themselves apparent. The Aurora Australis appeared to the Maori. A horned horse was seen by Basques as it ran through the streets of Vizcaya. Numberless other auguries. And the doorway to hell opened. The best thing about the passage quoted above is that we can feel Ellison taking off, pleased with the effect and balance of the language, and the particulars described, pushing it, having fun with it. Among those who escape hell during the brief period that the door stands open are Jack the Ripper, Caligula, Charlotte Corday, Edward Teach, Beard, still bristling but with the ribbons therein charred and colorless, laughing hideously, Burke and Hare, and George Armstrong Custer. All are sucked back except for Ellison's Lizzie Borden look-alike, Margaret Thrushwood. She makes her way to heaven, confronts Doc, and is sent back by God when a realization of the hypocrisy at work causes heaven to begin cracking and peeling around the edges. The pool of water Doc is soaking his feet in when Margaret drags her blackened, blistered body over to him begins to fill up with lava. Margaret returns to hell, realizing that she can take it, while poor Doc, who she still manages somehow to love, could not. "There are some people who just shouldn't be allowed to fool around with love," she tells God in the story's best line. Hitler, meanwhile, is still painting his roses just inside the portal to hell. He has been too absorbed to even think about escape when the door opened. God takes one look, Ellison tells us, and could not wait to get back to find Michelangelo, to tell him about the grandeur they had beheld there in that most unlikely of places. The grandeur Ellison wants us to see, of course, is not Hitler's roses, but Margaret's ability to love and to go on believing, if only in herself, in a world where the innocent are punished and the guilty rewarded. As in most of Ellison's fiction, the horror revolves around some smelly injustice. Its antidote lies most frequently in the human ability of his protagonists to surmount the unfair situation, or, lacking that, at least to reach a modus vivendi with it. Most of these stories are fables, an uneasy word in a period of literature where the concept of literature is seen to be a simplistic one, and Ellison uses the word frankly in several of his introductions to individual stories. In a letter to me, dated December 28, 1979, he discusses the use of the fable in fantasy fiction that has been deliberately laid against the backdrop of the modern world. "Strange Wine" continues, as I see it in retrospect, my perception that reality and fantasy have exchanged positions in contemporary society. If there is a unified theme in the stories, it is that. Continued from the work I have done in the previous two books, Approaching Oblivion 1974 and Deathbird Stories 1975, it tries to provide a kind of superimposed pre-continuum by the use and understanding of which the reader who leads even a lightly examined existence can grasp hold of his/her life and transcend his/her fate by understanding it. That's all pretty high-flown stuff, but what I mean, simply put, is that the workaday events that command our attention are so big, so fantastic, so improbable, that no one who isn't walking the parapet of madness can cope with what's coming down. Which reminds me of something that happened at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention. A UPI reporter asked me the eternal question, "Why do people read this horror stuff?" My reply was essentially Harlan's, "You try to catch the madness in a bell jar so you can cope with it a little better." "People who read horror fiction are warped," I told the reporter. "But if you don't have a few warps in your record, you're going to find it impossible to cope with life in the last quarter of the 20th century." The headline of the UPI squib that came down the wire and into newspapers coast to coast was predictable enough, I suppose, and exactly what I deserved for presuming to speak metaphorically to a newspaper man. King says his fans are warped. Open mouth, insert foot, close mouth. The Tehran hostages, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, the Howard Hughes fake biography and subsequent death, the Entebbe raid, the murder of Kitty Genovese, the Jonestown massacre, the H-bomb alert in Los Angeles several years ago, Watergate, the Hillside Strangler, the Manson family, the oil conspiracy. All of them are melodramatic and excessive beyond the ability of a writer of mimetic fiction to capture in fiction without being ridiculous. Yet all of them happened. If you or I were to attempt writing a novel about such things, before the fact, we'd be laughed out of the critical esteem of even the lowliest reviewer. I'm not paraphrasing the old saw that truth is stranger than fiction, because I don't see any of these events as mirroring truth or reality. 20 years ago, the very idea of international terrorism would have been inconceivable. Today, it's a given. So commonplace that we're unmanned and helpless in the face of Khomeini's audacity. In one fell swoop, the man has become the most important public figure of our time. In short, he has manipulated reality simply by being bold. How precise a paradigm he has become for the copelessness of our times. In this madman we have an example of one who understands, even if subcutaneously, that the real world is infinitely manipulable. He has dreamed and forced the rest of the world to live in that dream. That it is a nightmare for the rest of us is of no concern to the dreamer. One man's utopia. But his example, I suppose, in Cathexian terms, is endlessly replicable. And what he has done is what I try to do in my stories, to alter everyday existence in a stretch of fiction. And by the altering, by an insertion of a paradigmatic fantasy element, to permit the reader to perceive what he takes for granted in the surrounding precept in a slightly altered way. My hope is that the frisson, the tiny shock of new awareness, the little spark of seeing the accepted from an uncomfortable angle, will convince them that there is room enough and time enough, if only one has courage enough, to alter one's existence. My message is always the same. We are the finest, most ingenious, potentially the most godlike construct the universe has ever created, and every man or woman has the ability within him or her to reorder the perceived universe to his or her own design. My stories all speak of courage and ethic and friendship and toughness. Sometimes they do it with love, sometimes with violence, sometimes with pain or sorrow or joy. But they all present the same message. The more you know, the more you can do. Or as Pasteur put it, chance favors the prepared mind. I am anti-entropy. My work is foursquare for chaos. I spend my life personally and my work professionally keeping the soup boiling. Gadfly is what they call you when you are no longer dangerous. I much prefer troublemaker, malcontent, desperado. I see myself as a combination of Zorro and Jiminy Cricket. My stories go out from here and raise hell. From time to time, some denigrator or critic with umbrage will say of my work, "He only wrote that to shock." I smile and nod. Precisely. So we find that Ellison's effort to see the world through a glass of fantasy is not really much different from Kurt Vonnegut's efforts to see it through a glass of satire, semi-science fiction, and a kind of existential vapidity. Hi-ho, so it goes. How about that? Or Heller's efforts to see it as an endless tragicomedy played out in an open-air madhouse, or Pynchon's effort to see it as the longest-running absurdist play in creation. The epigram heading the second section of Gravity's Rainbow is from The Wizard of Oz. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Toto. And I think that Harlan Ellison would agree that this sums up post-war life in America as well as anything else. The essential similarity of these writers is that they are all writing fables. In spite of varying styles and points of view, the point in all cases is that these are moral tales. In the late 50s, Richard Matheson wrote a terrifying and utterly convincing tale of a modern-day succubus, a female sexual vampire. In terms of shock and effect, it is one of the best tales I've ever read. There is also a succubus tale in Strange Wine, but in Lonely Women Are the Vessels of Time, a succubus is more than a sexual vampire. She is an agent of moral forces, come to set things back in balance by stealing the self-confidence of a wretched man who likes to pick up lonely women in singles bars because they're easy lays. She exchanges her own loneliness for Mitch's potency, and when the sexual encounter is done, she tells him, "Get up and get dressed and get out of here." The story cannot even be described as sociological, although it has a patina of sociology. It is a moral tale, pure and simple. In Emissary from Hamelin, a child piper returns on the 700th anniversary of the abduction of the children from that medieval town and pipes Fini for all of mankind. Here, Ellison's basic idea that progress is progressing in an immoral way seems a bit shrill and tiresome. An unsurprising mating of the Twilight Zone moral stance with that of the Woodstock Nation. We can almost hear PA systems blaring, "And don't forget to pick up the garbage." The child's explanation for his return is simple and direct. "We want everyone to stop what they are doing to make this a bad place, or we will take this place away from you." But the words Ellison puts into his newspaper man narrator's mouth to amplify the thought smacks a little bit too much of Woodsy Al for me. "Stop paving over the green lands with plastic. Stop fighting. Stop killing friendship. Have courage. Don't lie. Stop brutalizing each other." These are Ellison's own thoughts, and fine thoughts they are, but I like my stories without billboards. I suppose this sort of misstep, a story with a commercial embedded in its center, is the risk that all fable fiction runs. And perhaps the writer of short stories runs a higher risk of falling into the pit than the novelist, although when a novel falls into this pit, the results are even more awful. Go down to your local library sometimes, get a stack permit, and look up some of the reporter Tom Wicker's novels from the 50s and 60s. Your hair will turn white. In most cases, Ellison goes around the pit, jumps over it, or jumps right into it on purpose, avoiding major injury either by his own talent, the grace of God, or a combination of the two. Some of the stories in Strange Wine don't fit so comfortably into the fable category, and Ellison is perhaps at his best when he is simply goofing with the language, not playing whole songs, but simply producing runs of melody and feeling. From A to Z in the chocolate alphabet is such a story, except it is not really a story at all. It is a series of fragments, some narrative, some not, that reads more like beat poetry. It was written in the window of the Change of Hobbit bookstore in Los Angeles, under circumstances so confusing that Ellison's introduction to the piece does not even really do it justice. The individual pieces produce individual little ripples of feeling, as good short poems do, and reveal an inspired playfulness with the language that is as good a place to conclude all this as anywhere else, I suppose. Language is play to most writers. Thoughts are play. Stories are fun, the equivalent of a child's tug-me-push-me car that makes such an entrancing sound when you roll it across the floor. So, to close, from A to Z in the chocolate alphabet, Harlan Ellison's version of the sound of one hand clapping. A sound which only the best fantasy horror fiction can provide, and set against it, a little something from the work of Clark Ashton Smith, contemporary of Lovecraft and something much closer to a true poet than Lovecraft could ever hope to be. Although Lovecraft desperately wanted to be a poet, I think the best we can say about his poetry is that he was a competent enough versifier, and no one would ever mistake one of his moody staves for the work of Rod McEwen. George F. Haas, Smith's biographer, suggests that Smith's finest work may have been Ebony and Crystal. And this general reader is inclined to agree, although few readers of modern poetry will find much to like in Smith's conventional treatment of his unconventional subject matter. I suspect, though, that Clark Ashton Smith would have liked what Ellison is doing in From A to Z in the Chocolate Alphabet. Here, preceding two selections from the Ellison piece, is a selection from Smith's idea notebook, published by Arkham House 2 years ago as The Black Book of Clark Ashton Smith. The Face from Infinity. A man who fears the sky for some indefinable reason and tries to avoid the open as much as possible. Dying at last in a room with short curtained windows, he finds himself suddenly on a vast bare plain beneath a void heaven. Into this heaven, slowly, there arises a dreadful infinite face from which he can find no refuge, since all his senses have apparently been merged in the one sense of sight. Death, for him, is the eternal moment in which he confronts the face and knows why he has always feared the sky. Now, the ominous jocularity of Harlan Ellison. He is for elevator people. They never speak, and they cannot meet your gaze. There are 500 buildings in the United States whose elevators go deeper than the basement. When you have pressed the basement button and reached the bottom, you must press the basement button twice more. The elevator doors will close, and you will hear the sound of special relays being thrown, and the elevator will descend into the caverns. Chance has not looked favorably on occasional voyagers in those 500 cages. They have pressed the wrong button too many times. They have been seized by those who shuffle through the caverns, and they have been treated. Now they ride the cages. They never speak, and they cannot meet your gaze. They stare up at the numbers as they light and then go off, riding up and down even after night has fallen. Their clothes are clean. There is a special dry cleaner who does the work. Once you saw one of them, and her eyes were filled with screams. London is a city filled with narrow, secure stairways. And finally, H is for hamadryad. The Oxford English Dictionary has three definitions of hamadryad. The first is a wood nymph that lives and dies in her tree. The second is a venomous hooded serpent of India. The third definition is improbable. None of them mentions the mythic origins of the word. The tree in which the serpent lived was the hamadryad. Eve was poisoned. The wood of which the cross was made was the hamadryad. Jesus did not rise. He never died. The ark was composed of cubits of lumber cut from the hamadryad. You will find no sign of the vessel on top of Mount Ararat. It sank. Toothpicks in Chinese restaurants should be avoided at all costs. So now, tell me, did you hear it? The sound of one hand clapping in thin air? 10. I began this chapter, 124 manuscript pages and 2 months ago, by saying that it would be impossible to effect an overview of horror fiction during the last 30 years without writing a whole book on the subject, and that is as true now as it was 2 months and all those pages ago. All I've been able to do here is to mention some books in the genre that I like, and hopefully draw short arrows in the direction these novels and stories seem to point. I haven't discussed I Am Legend, but if you should be intrigued enough to read The Shrinking Man as a result of what I've said here, you'll probably get to it and find Matheson's unmistakable trademarks on that book as well. His interest in restricting character to a single person under pressure so that character can be fully examined. His emphasis on courage in adversity. His mastery of terror against what appears to be a normal, everyday backdrop. I haven't discussed the work of Roald Dahl or John Collier or Jorge Luis Borges, but if you exhaust Harlan Ellison's current stock of offbeat, jivey fantasy, you will find these others, and in them you will find many of Ellison's interests repeated, particularly his examination of man at his worst, most venal, and his best, most courageous and true. To read Ann Rivers Siddons' novel of domicile possession may lead you to my novel on the same subject, The Shining, or Robert Marasco's brilliant Burnt Offerings. But a few short arrows is all I can possibly draw. To enter the world of horror fiction is to venture, small as a hobbit, through certain mountain passes, where the only trees which will grow are undoubtedly hamadryads, and into the equivalent of the land of Mordor. This is the fuming volcanic country of the Dark Lord, and if the critics who have seen it firsthand are few, the cartographers are fewer. This land is mostly white space on the map, which is how it should be. I'll leave more detailed map-making to those graduate students and English teachers who feel that every goose which lays gold must be dissected so that all of its quite ordinary guts can be labeled. To those figurative engineers of the imagination who cannot feel comfortable with the comfortably overgrown and possibly dangerous literary wilderness until they have built a freeway composed of Cliff's Notes through it. And listen to me, you people. Every English teacher who ever did a Monarch or Cliff's Notes ought to be dragged out of his or her quad, drawn and quartered, then cut up into tiny pieces, said pieces to be dried and shrunk in the sun, and then sold in the college bookstore as bookmarks. I'll leave the longer arrows to those pharmacists of creativity who cannot feel totally at ease until each tale, created to hold some reader spellbound, as each of us was at one time held spellbound by the story of Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, or The Hook, has been neatly dehydrated and poured into a gel capsule to be swallowed. That is their job, the job of dissectors, engineers, and pharmacists, and I leave it to them, along with a fervent wish that Shelob may catch them and eat them as they enter the Dark Lord's land, or that the faces in the Marsh of the Dead will first hypnotize them and then drive them mad by quoting Cleanth Brooks to them eternally in mud-choked voices, or that the Dark Lord himself will take them up to his tower forever, or cast them into the cracks of doom where crocodiles of living obsidian wait to crunch up their bodies and silence their quacking, droning voices forever. And if they avoid all that, I hope they catch poison oak. My job is done, I think. My grandfather told me once that the best map is one that points to which way is north and shows you how much water is in your way. That's the sort of map I've tried to provide here. Literary criticism and rhetoric aren't forms I'm comfortable with, but I'd just as soon talk books for, well, for 2 months at a time is the way it looks. Somewhere in the middle of Alice's restaurant, Arlo Guthrie tells his audience, "I could play all night. I'm not proud or tired." I could say much the same thing. I haven't talked about Charles Grant's Ox Run Station books or Manly Wade Wellman's Appalachian Bard, John, He of the Silver-Stringed Guitar. I've had only a chance to touch briefly on Fritz Lieber's Our Lady of Darkness. But, gentle reader, there is a pale brown thing in that book that will haunt your dreams. There are dozens of others. No, I take that back. There are hundreds